this handout that you read, which I think is a helpful introduction to the issue as a whole. And you have, when we think about this topic, there are entire courses in bioethics that focus for weeks on some of these topics. And so we are just trying to touch the surface in a very cursory way to get a sense for what's going on here, and to try to think about the theology behind how babies in our culture are oftentimes made, produced as the result not of simply sexual union between a man and a woman, but made as a result of some of the various technologies that we can now utilize to, in fact, bring people into existence. And so in your PowerPoint handout, I've given you a number, just some different samples from online articles that illustrate some of the moral and ethical dilemmas here. I'm not going to read these, but I'm just going to allude to them briefly. So you have first here, Kirk Maxey, father of 400 kids, demands sperm bank regulation. So you have someone who, thanks to modern science, has 400 children. That's interesting. Is there problems with this? Is there issues with that? You know, maybe. The next one here, this is an article from CNN. Kansas court says sperm donor must pay child support. So part of what's interesting about this case is that if you look at this article, it says a Kansas sperm donor caught in the middle of a child support case says he wanted to help a lesbian couple when he made the donation nearly 5 years ago. So what's the issue with the sperm donation? Well, at the bottom of this first page, it says documents show that a lesbian couple whom Murata helped conceive a child said they performed the artificial insemination procedure at home. So they didn't use a doctor, didn't use a clinic. It doesn't go into too much detail here exactly about this, but part of the point here is because they did it without the use of a doctor, without a registered doctor or sperm bank or something like this, he is now on the hook for child support. And so this is an interesting interesting dilemma. There's this phrase, where is it? At the top of page 3 of that article, it gives a quote here from a senior medical correspondent from CNN, and she says, for all they know, they were lovers. She said, they need that documentation. He's the dad, he ought to be paying up. So what I think is interesting about this is that you have to, if there's a chance that you might be lovers, right, think about that term, love, then you're responsible for child support. If you are a donation without being a lover, so to speak, then you are not responsible for paying child support, even though you are biologically the father. The next piece here is from the Washington Post, talks about surrogacy and some of the dilemmas there. There's a woman who agreed to be a surrogate mother. And in the process of this, she's not the biological mother, but she's carrying these children for someone else under contract. She's paid to do this. Instead of just carrying twins, she ended up carrying triplets. And the father, the person who was essentially had put her under contract, wanted to abort one of the children because he said, I can support two, but I can't support three. And so part of the question is, who has the right to determine that? Does the surrogate mother? Because in some sense, she's the carrier, but she is not the biological parent, but she is the gestational parent. So does she have the say over what goes on in her body here? Or how do we think about this? There's been a couple other cases that have surfaced like this that really help us see the dilemma of what happens when we start treating life and start treating children as a result of contracts. And so that's another piece there. And then finally, embryo adoption. This is a page that talks just a little bit about adopting, not children who have been born, but adopting embryos. In the process of fertility treatments, oftentimes people produce more embryos than are actually used. And so this government website points out that there are more than 600,000 cryopreserved embryos in the United States. So that's an issue of bioethics alone, especially if you believe that an embryo, a fertilized egg, right, is a human life. This means you have 600,000 humans in this state. Well, it says, a little bit later it talks about 60,000, which could be potentially made available for embryo adoption. And so that, so there's this broader pool of these embryos that are produced, and this is part of one of the dilemmas. If you are undergoing fertility treatment, usually you will produce more embryos than you would actually try to implant in the uterus. And so even if you were to say it's fine for a husband and wife to undergo this process of fertility treatment, how do you think about this as being just sort of a natural, normal part of this, that you have all these embryos that, are produced? And so part of what's happening through embryo adoption is you have couples who do have fertility issues who are adopting these embryos that are already out there. So instead of creating more of their own, they would see, again, see these as individuals, as persons who should be considered and treated as persons, and so would see this as an opportunity to use one of these embryos that's already formed. So in some sense, it's like adoption because you're not the biological parents. But there are other senses in which, obviously, that the embryo is implanted in the uterine wall. So the mother is the gestational mother. And so this is just, you know, it is a brave new world of technology and what people can do and what people can manipulate. And this just gives you some sense of it. And it, you know that something is really, you know, caught on in the popular culture when there's a Vince Vaughn movie about it. So this is just, this is a trailer, if you haven't seen the movie, but this is just a brief trailer that addresses, kind of from a comedic standpoint, the issue of sperm donation.
In my life, I have a tendency to make very bad decisions.
David, I don't want a boyfriend who just disappears because he's too busy. You're unreliable. You have brought me such beautiful flowers.
Yes, I did. Maybe that's why I've been stuck in the same job for so long.
You threw me out of blame, man.
You know, baby, it's, I love you like a son.
I am your son.
Everyone has a purpose in life. I guess I just haven't found mine yet.
David Wozniak, in 1994, you donated to a fertility clinic anonymously. Apparently, there was a mix-up at the clinic.
What?
You were the biological father of 533 children.
What? It is impossible to be the father of 533 children.
It is impossible to be the father of 4 children.
How would a normal person handle a situation like this?
A normal person would not be in this situation.
We're in trouble, David. Your kids are suing to find out who their biological father is.
What do we do now?
This envelope contains the profiles of your children. Do not open it. I know I shouldn't have, but I picked out one of the profiles. I just picked one. Worst idea ever.
I'm an actor missing the audition of a lifetime right now.
I'll take care of the coffee shop.
Who are you, man?
I can make a cup of coffee.
I lost my job.
You lost your job.
I got the part.
You got the part? This could be the most beautiful thing that ever happened to me. These kids need someone to look out for them.
Yeah!
They need a guardian angel.
Hey, sexy!
What are you doing? You ever seen a girl before?
When you're looking out for these kids, will you be wearing some kind of cape? I didn't say superhero. I said guardian angel. You do not want to reveal yourself.
You don't want to be known as the guy with 500 kids.
For the first time in my life, I'm doing the right thing. I officially set out to try and have a life.
Nice!
Maybe strange, a bit oversized, but it's my life. You don't have the skills to be a father.
Daddy!
Okay, stop it. I need order. And this is order?
Yeah. How many people have seen that movie? Just out of curiosity.
Only a couple.
Okay. It's a Vince Vaughn movie. So it is what it is. But one of the things I actually appreciate about it, you can even pick this up from the trailer, is that it underscores, you know, to be a parent doesn't mean you have everything under control and you have your life together. And that, I think, is one of the symptoms of our modern world, where it's kind of like, I can only do these things when I've got everything together. And the point is, nobody ever has it all together. But I think this does raise some interesting questions. So one of the key questions that Mylander underscores is this: do biological ties entail a fundamental identity and an obligation or responsibility? When we think about the fact that you are biologically related to someone, does that mean anything other than just, well, I'm biologically related to them? And part of what this movie illustrates is that there is some kind of connection or meaning there, that when he finds out he is the father of 500 plus kids, he doesn't just say that that's fascinating, but he perceives that there's some kind of connection. He wants to know something about who those children are, and assumes that that's going to help him understand something about who he is, and that maybe even in actually taking on a few of these obligations of fatherhood, you see him actually growing as much as Vince Vaughn is going to grow in a Vince Vaughn movie through this process. Yeah, you can even think about this in other through the venue of other lenses. I've been thinking about this especially in relationship to Star Wars and the way that family ties work there, right? So when Darth Vader says, "Luke, I am your father," does he just say, "Well, that's interesting information. Okay, and, you get that biological piece." Interesting. And so there's something there, right? That even, this is part of the discussion that I've had around the movie that just came out, is trying to know, who is Rey related to, right? Like, where are the family ties? Or is she Darth Vader reincarnated? This is my theory that I'm going with right now, that she's bringing balance of the force, dark and light, male and female. Right, you've got reincarnation, transgender, time travel. Seems to perfectly fit. Anyway, but probably not. Probably related to Obi-Wan Kenobi. But even that, it's interesting, right? This is part of what drives us. It is having some understanding of where we come from in a very basic way. Another key question, I think, is what view of the human person is entailed, especially in commercial reproduction? That is, that children are now the result of money changing hands, of paying a scientist or doctor to enable this to take place. So how does this work? And I think thirdly, how do Christians discern when something is morally permissible because it seeks to remedy something that has gone wrong? Okay, this is something I think that we would say as we've been talking about this. When we look at medicine, this is a key part of what medicine does. Is it intervenes to set something right that has gone wrong. So how do we think about this, especially in relationship to infertility? How do we determine when something is morally impermissible, just to say it's wrong to do this, because it goes beyond the limits that honor human dignity, to say that there are some things that we should not do, even if we can technically do them, there's something morally problematic. And especially when we're talking about fertility and infertility, trying to navigate these things is important. So those are kind of the overarching questions, and I think some of the specific cases that help to hone these are questions like this: should children of sperm donors have the right to know who their biological father is? In many cases, it is set up so that they cannot legally find that out, and so there are a number of different blogs that are by children of sperm donors who talk about going through this process of wrestling with this. Questions like this: is it morally permissible to unite part of you, sperm or egg, with a part of someone, sperm or egg, who's not your spouse to produce a child? So most people, I think, would instinctively say, well, it's wrong to have a child with somebody else if that entails intercourse. Is it wrong if it doesn't entail intercourse? Is it wrong for me to have a child with somebody who's not my wife? Or my wife to have a child with somebody who's not me? And so this is part of the question here. Or even if you think about to have a child with someone who is your spouse, but without intercourse, does that affect the meaning of what's going on here? All right, to go through these technical procedures, you get sperm and eggs, not by means of intercourse, but through some other means. And so that, again, is part of the question when we think about this. Should someone be paid for carrying someone else's child as a surrogate mother? Should the state allow or even demand that a birth certificate have the name of only two mothers or two fathers? Or should it list one father and one mother? This is part of the issue right now that in some states on birth certificates, it just lists, it's moving to the place where it just lists two people. It doesn't say father and mother. It just simply says parents. And so when we think about the term parent and child, do those terms actually mean something of substance, or do we get to define who is really the parent or who is really the child? And this is where things get, right, you do start to get into some interesting philosophical discussions, right? Do those terms have this meaning that we're not just free to alter and change? Well, when you have two mothers or two fathers, there's this desire to say, these are the parents, and so that's what's put on the birth certificate. How does that work? Is there such a thing as a right to have a child? When we talk about human rights, right, this is the language that our culture speaks about, and so who are you? If I want to have a child, who are you to get in the way of that? Maybe I'm not married, maybe I don't even have a significant other, but if I want to have a child by some of the means that are available out there, who are you to say or to inhibit that right? This question, which kind of relates to the one article that I pointed out, why are fathers of one-night stands forced to pay child support but sperm donors are not? Right, what is it that makes us think of one person as the father and therefore obligated, right? Because you're the father, you have these obligations, but in other circumstances, you're the father, you have no obligations. What is it that makes that status change in terms of our ethics? Now, Mylander touches on these, so I'm just going to briefly mention them here. Again, the complexity is great, and so you could go into more detail here, but I just want to highlight that there are different kinds of ART, or assisted reproductive technologies. So that's what. So when we talk about ART, that's what we're talking about. And so some of these have to do with you've got artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, you've got embryo donation or adoption, you have surrogacy, but all of these are in some cases that there's some kind of outside scientific medical assistance that is geared toward not just assisting with a pregnancy that's already underway, but actually with bringing a new person into existence. That's part of the distinction here. With these different kinds of ART, there are sometimes different parties involved. In other words, it could be a husband and wife who are struggling with fertility, and so they seek IVF, in vitro fertilization, as a way to enhance their fertility capability. But it could be that someone who is married or single seeks artificial insemination from a third party, somebody who they're not connected to, somebody who they're not married to. And so evaluating the ethics here, I think really does depend on recognizing the different parties that are involved and some of those factors as well. Again, when you think about reasons involved, again, it could be a husband and wife saying, we're struggling with fertility, and so this is why we want a child. It could be a woman who is single and wants a child, and so maybe there's not any prospects for marriage in her near future, so she's somebody who says, I want a child. Or it could be, in the case of this one article, it talks about a 50-year-old man from Atlanta who sought out this surrogate for children. I've read the article a couple times. I can't quite discern if he is married or not. And so it could work that way, too. So the reasons here can oftentimes be complex. There's also, I think, the question of money and contracts involved, that all of this is going to take money. And so that's one dimension, one factor in this. And when you start getting into contracts, especially around surrogacy, this is where it does raise questions, not only in surrogacy, but especially there, about how are we treating human beings? Are we treating them as products that we make, that we engineer, that we produce? Products who are, in some sense, bought and sold? I think we, you know, our culture is very aware of human trafficking and of the way we oftentimes exploit people and treat people as mere products. But sometimes we're not always so attentive to the way that attitude, that posture can creep into our discussion here. Now, I do want to underscore, when we talk about assisted reproductive technology, and when we talk about the fact that some of these things may be morally wrong or morally impermissible, this is not saying that if you are a person created as a result of this, that you have somehow have less human dignity or that you are less of a person. One of the things that Christian teaching affirms is that, you know, no matter that this is the case in terms of natural conception as well, no matter the circumstances of your conception, you are an image bearer of God. You are worthy of dignity and respect. And so I don't know, in the past I've had a couple students who have, you know, self-disclosed in a public way, not just to me, you know, that they are a test tube baby, a result of IVF or something like that. And that's the discussion about the morality of that is not a discussion about your inherent worth or dignity. So I don't want anybody, you know, today leaving class saying, well, you know, I'm here as a result of this, therefore is my very existence immoral? You know, should I just not be here? No. And we affirm that God is providential, even in and through sometimes humans doing things that are questionable. God works through this. I think one of the things to consider here is infertility and pastoral care, because a lot of times where we see this, at least where I've seen this within the church, is with couples who struggle with fertility. Right? That's why people would go to something like this. So a few things to emphasize. I think it's important to say that we affirm that something is not right. That, you know, this is part of the brokenness of sin, the brokenness of the fall, is that our bodies don't always function like they're supposed to. And so the fact, you know, we shouldn't just kind of, you know, say, oh, you know, get over it. Some people can have kids, some people can't. That there really is, when you look at Genesis 1 through 3, there's a sense in which children are a part of the good creational order that God made, that God ordained. And so it's okay to say something is not right. This should be a struggle. This should be a battle as you think about wrestling with this. But we also want to affirm God's providence and care. God knows, God hears, God listens. It's striking when you look at the Old Testament. You know, some of the central stories and central figures are about women specifically who are barren and who struggle with fertility. And part of the point is, in most of those situations, you know, that God sees, God hears, God cares. And so this is there. The other thing that's also interesting, you know, the Bible doesn't speak directly to these kinds of things, right? Because we're talking about modern technological advances. But it is interesting to think about, you know, the story of Abraham and Hagar as kind of this attempt to bring about a child outside of the marriage bond. And to see the way that God looks with compassion, cares for Hagar and Ishmael, even as they're driven out from Abraham and Sarah. But to see the way that this kind of human attempt to engineer God's plan does introduce a level of complexity and potential brokenness to the story. Not that God is absent from that, but that it certainly introduces that in a way that's problematic. And so we want to affirm God's providence and care even for those who are suffering with infertility. I think we also need to guard against idolatry. People can turn family, people can turn children into an idol. If God providentially, for whatever reason, has put you in a position where you're not able to have kids, don't make having kids an idol. I think this is a real temptation because there's, you know, occasionally I'll see, you know, people who are struggling with this where it's, this is kind of the be all and end all of their faith. You know, it can almost become kind of a prosperity gospel kind of thing where, you know, God is going to bless you. And so if you just have enough faith and if you just do the right things, then you'll have a child. That's not a promise we see in Scripture, that everybody is always going to have children. But I think what it does is, especially for couples who struggle with infertility, it helps us to recognize the struggle of others. If you have walked through something, you are uniquely positioned to comfort others who are walking through that same kind of ordeal and the same kind of situation. And so it's important, I think, for any struggle, for any difficulty, but for something like this to say, you know, how is God calling me to minister to others who might be walking through the same thing or something similar? And that God uses suffering, I think, in that way to help us be a ministry of comfort to each other. And I think finally, this is where we come back to the spousal meaning of the body. That part of what we see here is God's intentions for us is that we are called to give ourselves in self-giving love, and that marriage is a picture of that. The children are a picture of that, but that's not the only way that this can happen. And so I mentioned maybe a class period or two ago, if you go online and look at the article that Dr. Felch, actually Dr. Felch here and Dr. Felch, Dr. Doug and Dr. Susan Felch, wrote an article on infertility. And one of the things that they underscore is they talk about their own personal struggle with this, you know, kind of realizing at a certain point in life they were going to have to either invest very significant amounts of money and time and energy into having kids, or they could say God is calling us because of our infertility struggles to invest in other ways, in the lives of our students, in the lives of people in our church. And if you know Dr. Felch, I perceive that to be true. I mean, he should be keeping account of the number of people that they have actually invited up to their cottage, because I think it would probably number in the thousands. Wouldn't be surprising. That's a kind of hospitality that says there's still a commitment there to self-giving love, even if we don't have kids. And it's a recognition that we don't just say, yes, we don't have kids, so now we're not responsible. We can kind of just do whatever we want. But says, how do we pour ourselves out in other ways in service here? I think that one of the theological root issues when we talk about procreation and reproduction is this interesting question. So think about God's nature as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So that when we think about who God is as Trinity, does God the Father beget the Son by sheer choice, will, or by nature? So this is kind of a complicated theological question. But when we think about it, so think of it, if you can imagine it this way, does God the Father in eternity past sitting around saying, I think I'm going to beget the Son. Right? I shall do that. And now, again, this is where the analogy, we're trying to imagine this in eternity, that God the Father decides to have a Son? Or is it that God by nature, God the Father eternally begets the Son? I would say it's the second, that the Father by nature begets the Son. That this is who the Father is. And so this relationship between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is not simply one that kind of, you know, God could have been this relational Trinitarian God, or God could have been just this kind of single solitary God. By nature, God is relational. By nature, God is Trinitarian. By nature, God is this community of persons. And I think this is significant even when we think about creation. Now, this can get a little bit more tricky when you think about it. Does God create by sheer choice, will, or by nature? Now, I think here's why this gets tricky. Because if we say, well, we don't want to say that God had to create, right? That God was kind of forced to create. In fact, we emphasize God doesn't need to create us. Right? And so I think that's why we would probably tend to say, well, it is by God's will. Right? He decides that he's going to do this. But I think you could also look at it from the other angle and ask this question like this. When we think about who God is as creator, in some sense, isn't it his nature to create? That out of his overflowing love and abundance, he brings all things into existence. And so in some sense, yeah, God wasn't forced by anything outside himself to create, but it simply flows from who he is. That's the kind of God he is. That he is this creator, redeemer God. And so it's not simply a matter of mental choice or of will, but it simply flows from who he is. And here's where I think it is significant when we think about reproduction versus procreation. When we ask, who is more like God? Right? I think there's even this tendency, you start reading articles about this, and you know, scientists in the lab are playing God. Right? That they are now producing life in this way. And so this is almost our model of God. It's kind of the scientific model that God, by sheer choice, just decides to do this. When in fact, I think that this is part of why children flow from the context of marriage. that there's a sense in which within the marriage, within the married couple, this flows just from the nature of who we are. It's not just a matter of sheer choice or sheer will that I just wake up one day and say, yeah, I think I'm going to have a kid. Right? There it is. I'm going to just willingly choose this. But there's a sense in which children happen in ways that are not always intentional. Right? Now, in one sense, it's intentional. Right? Because anytime you engage in sexual union, it's possible. And so people are like, well, I didn't intend to have kids. Well, you intended something. Right? Something happened there. And I think this is helpful because, again, in our time, we think about ourselves as these kind of mental beings who live in the world primarily through our control and through our freedom and through our choice. And we're saying that even in our conception of God, we need to be careful here, that we don't kind of read our vision of who we are back onto God, but that this flows from who God is. Let me stop there a second. Questions or comments? Points of clarification. Does this make sense, or is this kind of? Yeah, so?
I think we might touch this later in the slides, but you know, one thing that really stood out to me in the reading is that the author thought assisted, you know, like something like assisted reproduction was even wrong, you know, even if you are between couples, even if you have a right understanding of what marriage is and things like that.
Yeah.
I know you briefly talked about Dr. Belch and how they, you know, decide to pour their life out to other people.
Yeah.
But can we say it's inherently wrong, or can we say, you know, it's idolatry even when married couples, you know, married Christian couples,
yeah,
to have a child?
Yeah. Yeah.
With right understanding of, you know, how marriage should look like, and with right understanding of, you know, about nature of marriage.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I wouldn't say it's wrong to have that desire for children, but I think, especially in cases where you have infertility struggles, it can become kind of the center, all-consuming kind of thing. And so that's where I think it could be wrong. I think, then to get at your other question, is your other question, you know, what about married couples using these? Is that a problem? And yeah, this is where you have, I think, where you have the most potential for disagreement, because it's a very subtle distinction. I think most people, or many Christians, like Mylander would say, as soon as you start bringing third parties into this, that actually is a problem. And so I think though where you get more complexity is to say, okay, what about a couple who's struggling with infertility, but what about them using in vitro fertilization or something like that, where the sperm and egg are from this married couple? And, you know, I have more openness or sympathy to that. The position that some take, including the Catholic Church, as we'll talk about in a minute, is that, you know, again, it's a question of not just the end goal, but the question of the means. So how do you get there? Well, you don't get there by means of sexual union. And so even the fact that, you know, if you're having sperm donation, typically those sperm have to come out in a way that is not connected to sexual union. And so even that act, as an act in and of itself, would be seen as morally problematic. Yeah.
To go off of that, the author talks about how, like, the whole begotten, not made aspect, yeah, and, like, how test tube babies or the assisted reproductive technologies makes a baby made, not begotten, because it's not out of the love for parents.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I kind of am skeptical about that, just because,
yeah,
like, it's not that the parents don't love each other.
Yeah.
And in some cases. In other cases, like the whole being single and wanting a baby, like that's,
yeah,
a whole different issue. But,
yeah,
like, right now, talking about married couples that struggle with infertility.
Yeah.
And it's not to say they don't love each other, that they haven't tried to have kids, but to say that they're, if they choose the assisted reproductive technologies, that their child is made, not begotten,
yeah,
kind of belittles the child and the married couple as a whole. So I don't know. I was skeptical about that.
Yeah. And that I think, again, is why I'm more sympathetic to this within the context of marriage than not. I think the point in terms of the response that somebody might make is that when they talk about love, they're talking about even the act itself by which the child is it comes into existence. There's a difference between sperm being injected into an egg in a laboratory. That's a different kind of act than sexual union, which is a different. So that's where I see, when you talk about love, I think that does apply globally, so to speak, to their marriage and their relationship. But the objection from the other side would be the particular act has to be this kind of act as well. But that's exactly, I think, the point of complexity.
Because
there's a sense in which you would say the fact that this child, I'm kind of skipping ahead and we're doing some different things, whatever, it's PowerPoint, who cares. the fact that we're saying, children are meant to be this sign and seal of the parents' love. Like, they're this one flesh embodiment of the parents' love. And so I think that's part of why there is this deep desire to have a child that in some sense embodies that. And so, I think that's why when married couples struggle with that, they do want to pursue these different means to that end.
Another frequency for fertility treatment is simply to give pills or injections for different hormones to reset wrong hormones. That would be assisted, but it's certainly the same act.
Yeah. And so that's a different, so that would be a substantially different kind of act, because you're, in some sense, what you're doing is not an act that brings sperm and egg together, but you're doing something that's meant to enhance the fertility, the natural fertility that's there. Now, even that has some issues, right? If somebody is given fertility treatments and they have, octuplets, right? And at what point do you start to say, we're kind of going beyond our limits here in a way that's actually harmful to the babies that are produced as a result of this? Like, how do we negotiate that?
That's it.
I mean, just a little backtrack on what Maris is talking about, but wouldn't the, if the couple, the married couple is engaged in, in the marital act with openness to children, regularly, they have that one flesh union.
Yeah.
Why would, it seems that if they are, they have that bond and they have that desire, so the fact that separate from the exact instant of that one flesh union that there was insemination taking place, it seems like, I mean, I know that that specific union did not exactly result in that specific child, but they're still fulfilling the requirements of the spousal meeting and body and those sorts of things as far as an openness to children. And then, so they're still fulfilling that.
Yeah. Yeah, so they would be fulfilling it, I think, in that sense of totality or that global sense. But this is where, as with contraception, it comes down to the means of the act itself. So the specific act of insemination is not the same as the act of sexual union. And so it really is more of this debate about what's the ethics of that means as opposed to that end. At a certain point, it's like, it is just, that's just the difference. Like, it's two different kinds of acts. Yeah.
So, I think a question that we need to ask or have answered is sexual union the highest act of love that we as humans can give? Because if it is, then there is a difference. But if it's not, if humans can give an act of love in different ways, and different acts of love can be the same or higher, or whatever the case may be, of sexual intercourse, then I would say assisted reproductive technologies can be a way that doctors can lovingly help a couple who is trying to create another life out of love. And that can be if sexual intercourse is not the highest form of any act of love, then it can be just as good as then the assisted reproductive technologies can be just as loving and just as much out of love as sexual intercourse.
Yeah. And so I think that that's a good observation to try to sort through, because I think the way you framed it is important. How do we, or what is it precisely that would be an ethical dilemma or problem with assisted reproductive technologies? Because I would say there are, right, the love can manifest itself in all kinds of ways. And so how we think about that is not, so the issue is not just that this act is not loving, but that the act of bringing someone into existence is actually meant to happen only within certain parameters. And that part of the problem would not be the doctor's loving desire to help the couple, but that the means that the doctor would use, I think. But we'll come back to this in a minute with a couple of these analogies. But I think that's exactly how you would, from a medical perspective, say, you know, the goal here is to take something that has gone wrong, and you're trying to find a remedy for that. You're trying to help what's gone wrong there. And that would be seen, I think, you know, that's how your doctor shows you love, is by trying to correct what's gone wrong. Just very briefly, I think it's worth reflecting on the fact that our lenses on sex connect with our lenses on children. Yes.
I have a quick question, kind of going back.
Okay.
How do we think about like C-sections then? Because do they do C-sections like in, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, or is that something that, I mean, obviously it's not like medical, or I mean, it's not like pills and,
yeah,
and taking semen and everything, but it is different. It's not natural. Like, do you not do it?
Yeah.
Right? Because I've got a friend who's getting, you know, induced this Saturday, and she's diabetic, and she most likely is going to have a C-section. It's like, how do you, is she not allowed to have a baby because she can't, you know, have it the normal way?
Yeah.
Is it, you know, what do you, I don't know. That was just one of those thoughts. Is that, maybe that's taking it too far, but.
Yeah. No, but I think that's exactly the kind of thing where I have to think about how are these similar or different? And so I think the response of, you know, why would having a C-section be seen as morally permissible? Because in some sense, you're taking, something's going wrong with the body, so that it's not able to fulfill this natural function of having a child in a normal way. And so you're intervening to try to remedy what's gone wrong with that.
Okay.
And so because of that, this connects again to this idea of our organs and our body as a whole has this kind of telos, or our organs are meant to function a certain way. So if those break down, there's nothing morally wrong with intervening to set those back to working as they should. And so that's where I think the C-section would be. Well, we'll think about whether that is different or not from a couple who's struggling with infertility. All right, so I'm not going to say too much here, but just to say that to try to tease out how this works, if you think about sex through this kind of plain sex lens, if children then are just the biological result, why do we seem to attach such meaning there? Like, do we do attach meaning to parenthood and to children and to lineage? When we think about expressive lenses, this is where it gets interesting in our culture, where just as people might seek a sexual partner to express themselves or seek some kind of fulfillment, this is where increasingly people, including single people, want to have children as a way to, you know, kind of use these ARTs to enhance something about their life. I would feel more fulfilled if I have children. I don't have a spouse. I don't have a significant other. But this would be a way for me to grow, to express myself, so I can use those technologies to do this. Power, I think certainly, you know, when we think about how this works with assisted reproductive technologies, clearly there's a sense of power when we kind of know how to produce this new life and what this looks like. I think the question is, should this be, this is very much a unilateral expression of power, right? Those who bring the child into existence are very consciously, freely determining to do this. Now, even with assisted reproductive technologies, there's all kinds of things that don't go as people would like it to go. But You know, this is, I think this is oftentimes the reverse of people's feelings, you know, when they find out that they are pregnant or expecting. It's very much a sense of something from outside, maybe outside my intentions, has overpowered me to this place where I'm now, whether I like it or not, whether I've chosen it or not, I'm now a father or a mother. And so the power in that sense is very much not this kind of unilateral power, but it's this recognition that this child places certain demands on me, as opposed to me bringing the child in some sense into existence through these different means. Romantic lens. Yeah, I was thinking about how to translate this into lenses on children. I think that, you know, part of this comes from the way we, maybe even in our culture, romanticize parenthood and what that's about, you know, that our goal is to make sure our kids are just, you know, it's like wonderfully happy all the time, and et cetera, as opposed to like, this was more about thinking about what are your obligations towards your kids and what are their obligations towards society? How are you being called to train them up as citizens of God's kingdom, as citizens of the state and society where they live? I think this can maybe have an effect there. When we think about it through the covenantal and procreative lens, I think, you know, the covenantal lens underscores that the child is the one flesh bond of the parents. In the procreative lens, I think what is emphasized here is that the child's very self is a result of self-giving love. That's meant to be the goal, that's meant to be the intention. And so the child is in some ways the natural extension of the marriage, a natural extension of the self-giving love that is there. When we think about the meaning of sexual union then, just as we've said with contraception, part of the issue is can you willfully divorce fruitfulness from sexual union? This is just the mirror image of the question here around assisted reproductive technologies. Can you take children out of the context of a marriage, out of the context of sexual union? And what does that do when we create this divorce between the fruitfulness of our bodies and this context of marriage? And so it really does, you know, it's no wonder then that we, in a world, for example, where we have this kind of plain sex lens, that we would tend to start treating children just as kind of material products that we reproduce at will. Because that's kind of how we're, the way that we view sex is going to be how, is going to affect the way that we view our children. The point here, when we talk about this new person, this kind of gets to the question of, well, what's the difference between a child created in a laboratory versus a child created in your parents' bedroom or wherever? Okay, the new person as the result of a personal act. That when you think about sexual union, this is meant to be an act of two persons. It's meant to be an act of the whole person. And so there's something that's meant to be especially particular and peculiar about sexual union, that you get this new self only as a result of this union of these other two selves. That is different from the kind of act that happens where you in some way, shape, or form extract sperm and egg from one or more partners. It's just a different kind of act. And that's, again, precisely the moral question, is does that act matter, or how much does that act matter, the fact that we can change it. One of the things that I think that is worth thinking about maybe that we don't always recognize is that part of the bond of marriage, part of the unity of marriage, is that we're, I think in some sense, promising that we will become parents only through each other. You know, I will be, you know, when I think about my relationship with my wife, part of what I'm promising is I'm not going to have kids with anybody else, precisely because kids have this deep theological meaning. And so I'm only going to have children in and through you, and she's only going to have children in and through me. This is part of why Mylander, I think, kind of as a whole, says third-party assisted reproductive technologies create a lot of problems. Because essentially what you're doing is you are introducing another person into that marital relationship. Right? We tend not to think of that way, because I think clearly most people, even people without, you know, a Christian ethical background, would say there's probably a problem if there's a third partner in your marriage bed. Right? They would see that as a problem. But part of what this does is it kind of introduces a third party in a different way. And so it's worth thinking about this. When we approach this, I think from a worldview lens, you have three key questions that we're asking is, What did God intend? When you look at creation, what are God's creational intentions? What has gone wrong in the fall? And in terms of redemption, what can be or what should be set right and restored? And in particular, part of what we think about here under redemption is, you know, what is God's role and what is our role? Because we realize, hopefully we realize, for the love of God, that our role is not the same as God's role in redemption. That God does things that we cannot do. And that there are some things that we can do, some things that we should do, some things that we should not do. Right? I sometimes see this, right, even in our broader cultural approach, you know, when Christians talk about transforming the culture. I'm not sure if that's something that we even can do, much less should we try to do this. I'm convinced we're called to live faithfully as God's people, as the church. But I don't know if Scripture ever kind of holds out this hope that, you know, the entire culture is going to be transformed around us. Maybe it will. If so, great. Maybe not. If not, have we failed? Not necessarily. And so it's important in all these areas to think about what is God's role, what's our role, and to think about these limits here. And so one thing that's put forth, and Mylander addresses this a bit, is ART like adoption. So adoption seeks to set right something that's gone wrong with the world. Children who either have no parents or whose parents cannot fulfill their obligations to them. ART seeks to set something right that has gone wrong with the world. People who cannot have children but want them. And so this would be kind of an argument by analogy, saying, look, I think everybody would recognize adoption is morally permissible, even though most people say adoption is not ideal. In a perfect world, right, everybody would be able to take care of their own children. You wouldn't have situations where adoption was necessary. But it is morally permissible. There's nothing wrong with it. Therefore, because of this similarity, ART is morally permissible. And so I think when we look at this, you know, the way that we could break this down in adoption, God intended children to have two present parents. Fall, for various reasons, neither parent can support the child. And in redemption, others would step in to fill the parental role because the biological parents cannot. Now, I think even to think about adoption, I think underscores the fact that we recognize that there's these built-in biological ties also have ethical demands, and there are also ethical limits. So, you know, you might say, I don't really think that parent is doing that great job of parenting, but does that mean we can step in and take their kids? Only usually in pretty extreme circumstances. There's quite a number of things that have to be met before a child is going to be removed from a home because a parent not fulfilling their obligation, right? You can say, well, that parent, you know, lets them watch TV 8 hours a day. You know, they're not feeding them healthy. They're not, you know, helping them get some basic life skills. Even those things are not grounds for removing a child from a home. Why? Because you assume there's some kind of tie there that has this basic bond of obligation. But if there are situations where the biological parents cannot, others step in then to do that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in fact, that's usually a great act of self-giving love, that people would be willing to do this. But I think there are some differences. And so when you think about assisted reproductive technologies, especially things like artificial insemination, surrogacy or others, there's this difference that one or both biological parents are actually paid to renounce any parental bond. Right? Maybe you haven't thought about it this way before, but I mean, this is part of why, again, this whole case where the kind of at-home sperm donor gets charged with paying child support, because he hasn't signed a contract essentially saying, I renounce, you know, and give up my rights, and by the way, the child is now not going to be able to track me down. Or find me. And so there's a sense where we set up a contract, we set up a situation where one of the biological parents actually renounces this bond from the get-go, right? So it's not like somebody, it's like, well, I'm pregnant and I'm, you know, just, I'm not able to keep the child. This is where somebody heads into conception with the idea of renouncing that parental bond or that parental obligation. Another difference here is that adoptive parents seek to mitigate difficult circumstances of an already existing child. Whereas in many cases of ART, the legal parents initiate the process that brings the child into existence. So it's not as though we're saying, you know, what is being treated here? It's not the case of a child who has a need. It's my need to have a child. And that's a couple of different things. You know, part of the question is, can we say, it is my desire to have a child, is that something that ethically can be met at any cost? Or are there some limits to that desire to have a child? To say, you know, there are some ways that this could be brought into, that a child could be brought into existence, some ways not. Children, and oftentimes of ART, are the product of a contractual relationship, not necessarily the marriage relationship alone. And so that even if you think about, you know, a couple seeking fertility treatment, there is this level of contractual relationship that they have with the doctor or with other medical sources that builds on top of this. And so this is where we start thinking about them from a medical angle. Well, is that wrong? What exactly is being treated here? And how should we approach this case of infertility? So here's another analogy, I think, that tries to get at that. Is ART like organ donation? Okay, so organ donation seeks to set right something that goes wrong because of sin and death in the world. Organ failure. ART seeks to set right something that goes wrong, infertility, because of sin and death in the world. Organ donation is morally permissible, therefore ART is morally permissible. So this would be kind of, again, the argument by analogy of saying, you know, this is like organ donation. So again, we think about organ donation through the lens of creation, fall, redemption. It says, creation says, look, our bodies were meant to function properly and in a healthy manner. Because of the fall, though, our various organs sometimes break down. Things are not like they're supposed to be. This happens. When we think about what it would mean to redeem this or to set this right, then, part of this is that organs of deceased persons can be transplanted. Or in the case, I suppose, of kidneys of live persons, but oftentimes this is deceased persons. So it takes a less than ideal situation, but it's meant to correct something that's gone wrong so the whole body functions in a healthy manner. And so this would be the idea behind organ donation and why I think, you know, most people would say organ donation is permissible, even though it does provoke other questions. I remember one time at, you know, my church growing up, that there was somebody who was a little bit concerned that if they did organ donation, when the resurrection or the rapture happened, they were wondering, like, are people's organs going to be, like, flying back to their rightful bodies? And how would this, how does this work? And so that's when it's kind of like, well, it is, it's our same bodies, but it's not necessarily, like, your liver has probably turned to dust by them. And so God is reconstituting your body. It's not like your same liver is kind of in the ground. Like, it's pretty much gone by then. Yeah.
I believe it's the Jehovah's Witness who don't believe in organ transfers or blood transfers or any of that stuff that they believe in.
Oh, yeah.
Jehovah's Witness.
Because you don't want to, yeah. Anyway, so this would be the idea behind organ donation. And so again, people would say, well, look, you know, just like we correct an organ that is not functioning properly, isn't there a sense in which, you know, infertility shows something's not functioning properly as well? I think there are some differences, though. When you think about an organ and what's being replaced here, you're talking about a particular part. You're not talking about bringing a whole new organism, right, a whole new person into existence. That's a different level of what we're actually trying to do here. And again, I think that when we think about the difference of part versus whole, yeah, there is something to be said, I think, for fertility treatments that correct parts of the male or female body that are not functioning as they should. Okay, and trying to make sure that those parts are functioning well. But if we go beyond the bounds of that, I think we start to get into some dangerous territory, because what we're doing is, again, we're not correcting a malfunction of a body, we're actually producing a new person. That's a different, you know, that we're not just remedying something that's wrong, we're actually going beyond that. And so this is where I think there is a difference between saying we're fixing a currently existing body that's not operating like it should, versus we are going to bring a whole new body, a whole new person into existence. That is a different level. One question around this is sometimes raised by those who deal with the bioethics here. You know, think about this. If we think that selling organs is morally wrong, we don't allow this in our culture, then why is selling sperm, eggs, and wombs right? So we won't sell parts of the body, but we'll sell you the parts of our body that actually make another human person. This seems to be more extreme, right? I would say if, you know, if we can sell, if you think it's morally permissible to sell these, then why can't somebody sell their kidney on a legitimate market? Yeah.
I would say the difference there would be that I would see the moral question in selling the organs makes it something that someone's life is depending on goes to the highest bidder, whereas since somebody's current life or death is not at stake in their desire to have children, that would be
yeah.
why I would not see them.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. All right, we'll stop here for next time. You've got the handout from John Piper. We're going to be getting into talking about gender roles and fun stuff there. So switching gears, but a lot to talk about there as well. All right, see you then.
What's selling plasma then?
What's that?
What's selling plasma then? What's selling plasma?
I know. I was
well, yeah.